Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectaculario, prepping the hell out of his bar exam, Andy D. Bailey. Co-host Andy D. Bailey, excuse me. We have, as usual, a bunch to get to, or at least a bunch to try and get to, but before we start, I would just like to remind, plead, beg, implore everyone to continue rating us on iTunes. It takes 15 seconds out of your day. Just throw Hardwood Knox into the search bar, leave us a rating, leave us a review, definitely subscribe if you haven't done that already. Get in the habit of borrowing people's phones and doing it for them. We would really appreciate it. We love seeing those numbers go up. We definitely do not like seeing them go down, as they have since we last recorded for some strange reason. Also,
you Illuminati.
That was what I talked about too. You can also still get 15% off at the MBA Math Shop. That's mbamath.com/shop. Promo code Benno, B-E-N-O, should be easy enough to remember because a certain someone shouts him out at the end of every single podcast. And with that out of the way, we get to the opening question that everyone is always dying to know the answer to. Andy, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to be talking about some NBA instead of torts and civil procedure and evidence. Those are the subjects that have just been pounded into my head like a jackhammer for the last couple weeks.
You sent me one of your questions in our text thread before, like our text box, whatever, before we started, and I haven't, like, I just scanned it, and I have, like, a headache, because it was so long.
I love when the lawyers who put all this stuff together think they're being funny, because that question that I sent you is like a, it's like a parody of Snakes on a Plane. So, congratulations to you guys who are the bar examiners or bar preppers for your sense of humor.
That should be your job, because then you can do like a John Wick 3 featuring Boban question.
Oh, that would be incredible. By the way, that's like the, in a season full of just wild news all over the place, that might be my favorite.
That's like, that's the biggest like news item we've had in the past decade.
There are so many NBA stars over the last few years, but I watch them play and I'm like, that guy needs to be in an action movie. I always thinking about Steven Adams. I thought it about Gortat. Who was the guy that was on the Hawks that was he went back overseas. I can't believe I'm blanking on his name right now. Big guy who shot threes, bald.
Oh my God. Something with a P,
I'm gonna
right?
have to look this up.
Why can't
say
I
say it again?
Something with a P, isn't it? Peroantich?
I feel so, is that Peroantich? I think that's right. I always thought he should be in an action movie, and now we're finally getting it. Yeah, it's Peroantich. Good call. I don't think it could be much better than Boban.
I mean, it can't. He's monstrous.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun to see him show down with John Wick.
We have, I don't know how many of them we're gonna get to, but we're finally gonna get to the off-season outlooks for the Celtics, Pelicans, Rockets, and Jazz. I'm sorry, I forgot your Jazz for a minute. But before
Can't
we
believe
get
you.
There, I just want to know if you have, as we're recording this, about, I don't know, 36 hours until the NBA Finals Game 3, Cavs down 2-0. Any Finals thoughts you'd like to relay other than it's really sad that the NBA season's about to be over?
I guess it's bittersweet for me that the NBA season's about to be over, because every year I'm like ready for the off season. By this point, I'm ready for player movement. I'm ready for crazy rumors. I'm ready for the draft. All that stuff is, I was just thinking the other day, somebody actually tweeted this and I can't remember who it was, but they said something like team building is actually more exciting to them than X's and O's. And I think I might be in the same boat. I love everything that goes into team building. So the off season is really like, that's my jam. So, would it be cool if we had a slightly more competitive finals? Obviously, game one was, but I'm with you. After game two, I'm starting to feel like my Warriors and Six call was kind of crazy. it'd be nice if it was slightly more competitive, but at this point, I am just kind of ready for for us to move on to the to really fun stuff.
I like, I'm kind of with you, but at the same time, I was just really hoping against hope that I'd be wrong and that this would be a competitive series, or at least one that might go longer than we expected. But it's just that game one loss was just so demoralizing, and I don't know if Cleveland...
Yeah, that's hard to bounce back from.
Yeah, I just, they don't look like a team that's going to have the mental gall to get through it. And one of the bigger problems is their second best player in Kevin Love. He could be wide open in the corner, and you just don't trust him to make those shots.
And no.
And that's like, that's Cleveland's situation in a nutshell at this point. So maybe they'll bounce back in game three because their role players tend to shoot better at home. But
yeah,
I mean, you've got J.R. Smith shooting 20% on wide open threes. Jeff Green, 25% on wide open threes. Kevin Love's been shooting since the conference finals. I looked this up yesterday. Is shooting about 33.3% on wide open threes since the conference finals. That you need.
It's got to be better. Yeah.
Yes, it has to be. It has to be way better.
And the thing is, even if one or two of those guys do start hitting in Cleveland, it's like that's enough to give you a small chance. Because they played. I mean, they got an incredible game out of LeBron. They got a little bit of help from Kevin Love. He wasn't super efficient in game one, but at least he had 20-plus points. And that was enough to get them to a point where they had a chance in the last minute or two. It's like they're playing with the most razor-thin margin of any finals team I can remember.
Yeah, and it's not even if it might be thinner than that somehow. So I hope they need – it's not even – this is the lazy take, is to say they need to get game three. Obviously, they need to get game three. No one's come back from a 3-0 lead. It's not happening now. My thing is they need to get the first quarter of game three, because you'll probably know within the first 6 or 8 minutes whether they have a chance of winning that game. If they just come out –
well, and then even if they do get the first quarter, even the first half, I don't think I'd feel comfortable until they get through that third quarter that the Warriors have crushed so many teams in over the last 4 years.
You wouldn't feel comfortable, but again, I think you have like a feeling.
It helps for sure. Yeah.
That they'll be competitive, or the game could be competitive by midway point of the first quarter. But if the Warriors get, if they're just up 7 or 8 points by like the 6 or 8 minute mark of the first, it's just over. I just don't trust. And this isn't specific to the Cavs necessarily, but anytime the Warriors go up like 7 or 9 points, I'm just like, oh, that's insurmountable. No one's coming back from that.
Yeah. And then, like, even last year, it didn't feel quite as bad because Cleveland had so much firepower last year, too, compared to this team. So, yeah, I'm with you. So, like, anything above 7 or 8 points, it's like, well, this one's kind of in the books.
It's like, get Rodney Hood on the floor. It's the garbage time.
Man, poor Rodney Hood.
I feel like he did
maybe
this to himself.
We'll talk about this when we do the Cavs postmortem, but man, he's cost himself a lot of money.
Yeah, the only way, and maybe I thought, we talked about this, I think, in the finals preview, I thought maybe he would get a real chance in the finals just because a 6'7", 6'8", wing, even one who's not particularly long, I just thought would have some value in this series, especially when the alternative included playing Jordan Clarkson. But, I mean, we'll have to see whether they dust him off for Games 3 or all of Game 4. Could definitely be garbage time if the Cavaliers are down 3-0.
Did you see his quote the other day about watching videos of himself in Utah?
No. Was this the one? Yeah, did you see the thing about him saying it's tough to play with LeBron, too?
Oh, I didn't see that one. That's pretty funny in combination with what... The one I saw was... He said he watches YouTube videos of himself from earlier in the season to remind himself that it was the same year and he's still that guy.
That's like...
That's rough.
I'm seeing that quote now. At times when I may lose a little bit of confidence because of playing time or whatever, I look back to my Utah highlights a lot on YouTube just to remind myself that that was this year when I did those things.
It's crazy.
And then he also, in that same article... he said, this is something different. It has been tough. The basketball stuff has been the easiest part. The stuff that comes out of it, you lose a game and everyone talks about it on TV the next day. They may say some things that you may not agree with. If you win a game, you're supposed to. Those kind of things are something that I kind of got on a much smaller scale and dealt with at Duke. He just basically said, you win, it's like you're supposed to win. It's still a struggle to me to adapt to that. Is that like throwing shade at the Jazz there too? And he caught, you're
yeah,
right.
Probably.
He just cost himself a crap ton of money. And that was from ESPN. So, the undefeated's Mark J. Spears, excuse me.
One last thing on that. If you listen to this podcast, you probably already know this, but zero is an average box plus minus. Minus two is a replacement player box plus minus. Rodney Hood this postseason is -6.8, and Jordan Clarkson is -9.3. Hood's PER is 6.1, and Clarkson's PER is 3.3.
That seems low. Is that low?
Cleveland has four guys with at least 100 playoff minutes and a PER below 7.
That seems like a problem.
As a business owner, do you ever wonder if your business ever closes early when you aren't there? Or if it opened on time this morning? Stop wondering. With Smarter Business Security powered by Alarm.com, get alerts sent directly to your phone when your business opens and closes. An all-in-one service that helps you understand who's coming and going in one store or across all your store locations. Know everything that's happening at your business with Smarter Business Security powered by Alarm.com. See how by visiting alarm.com/business today. As a business owner, do you ever wonder if your business ever closes early when you aren't there? Or if it opened on time this morning? Stop wondering. With Smarter Business Security powered by Alarm.com, get alerts sent directly to your phone when your business opens and closes. An all-in-one service that helps you understand who's coming and going in one store or across all your store locations. Know everything that's happening at your business with Smarter Business Security powered by Alarm.com. See how by visiting alarm.com/business today.
It's just crazy the load that LeBron has had to carry.
In game two, it kind of seemed, at least at the beginning, that he... I'm not saying he was boycotting aggression, but it seemed like this was his last-ditch effort to be like, I'm going to pass the ball as much as humanly possible and get my teammates shots, and maybe that will put them in a comfort zone. And then it really just, with the exception of George Hill and then Kevin Love for brief stretches, it just didn't.
Yeah, I feel like it almost feels like George Hill has to have like 25 points for them to have a chance.
Yeah, like 50.
He was super aggressive at the start of game two, and then it just kind of faded, as it sometimes does with him. But Kevin Love is like a wild card at this point. You need at least one person beyond him to go off. And I don't – is there anyone else besides George Hill who might do that? I've lost all faith in J.R. Smith.
Oh, and I don't blame you for that. And the way that Korver has been blanketed off the ball,
yeah,
it's impossible for him. I'm not – I think it's easy for us to sit here as armchair analysts and say, Ty Lue should do this, Ty Lue should do that. One of the things, though, that I've never really understood is – the reluctance to put Kyle Korver on the floor for extensive minutes in this series when it specifically pertains to his defense. J.R. Smith isn't that much of an upgrade. Jordan Clarkson is probably a downgrade. And for me, I feel like Korver tries. Even if the results are bad, he'll chase loose balls. He tries to get around screens. He tries. In support of Ty Lue, though, you can't have him on the floor for 17, 20, 25 minutes a game and only take three shots. He has been absolutely just stymied off the ball.
Yeah.
It got to a point where he took three shots in game two, and two of them were just like, I have the ball, I need to shoot. But like he doesn't need much daylight, but the Warriors give him zero. And that's probably where having him on the floor just isn't worth it. Because if he's not, he needs to at least take a bunch of shots, because that him being a threat. Other than that, you can look at him as a decoy, and you say, hey, we'll put him, we're not going to move him much off the ball because it might bring guys closer to the point of the attack on these plays, and we'll just put him in the corner, and maybe that takes Klay Thompson at the defensive play. Either way, I'm playing him, but I'm saying that's a problem
that's
in
a
this
good,
series.
Yeah. At least try to make it like a game of 4-on-4.
Or just something. I think he can be important in any way, but that's definitely one of the, he would be, I think for the playoffs this year, you would say he's probably the second or third most likely Cav to go off. And in this series, he's probably not, because the Warriors have just absolutely wet blanketed him.
Yep. they've done a really, really good job on him. I kind of like that idea that you threw out. It's certainly time for them to at least try to get creative.
I like that you like one of my ideas for a change.
For a change.
So I think that the finals, do you think it's a sweep? Or is it going to be a sweep?
Man, I'll still say five. I'm downgrading from my Warriors and six pick. I'm tempted to go sweep now, but I'll go ahead and say five.
I just think LeBron, even if it's in the 3-0 and it's a meaningless game, I think he gets them a game still. I'll stick with
yeah. Warriors. That's kind of how I'm feeling. Yeah,
it would be great if they won Game Three, and I'm someone who roots for chaos, but like at this point, I want a good series. I would love for them to win Game Three because then it creates like this semblance of hope leading into Game Four, where
yeah.
Oh, if they win, it's tied 2-2, and you go back to good blah 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 blah, and anything could happen. So here's yeah. to the Cavs winning Game Three. I'm officially
here's to
a Cleveland fan.
LeBron having like a 50-point triple double and three guys hitting more than 50% of their threes,
and the Cavaliers still losing. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm like almost. You're not going to believe this headline that TMZ Sports tweeted out as we're recording this.
Let's hear it.
Ezekiel Elliott and Dak Prescott hit the club, penis guns blazing.
No, I cannot believe that headline. You're right.
That I don't know. Now I really want to move on. Where do you want to start? I'm going to give you carte blanche here of those four teams. Wherever your heart desires, we will jump into.
Well, this should be predictable, but I'm going to go with the Jazz.
I honestly thought you were going to go with your favorite team, the Pelicans, but go ahead.
How do we want to approach this? Last night I was kind of prepping for today's episode a little bit. I feel like the likely outcome after this offseason is that Utah returns roughly the same team they had this year. There were reports a few months ago that their eyes are more on next summer's free agency than on this summer's mm-hmm. when guys like Klay Thompson are possibly available. Although since then, there's been other reports that say Klay Thompson might sign for the Warriors for less. So that
gotta save significantly Joe Lake for that money.
Yes, significantly dampens Utah's hopes for someone like that. But I think they probably are still sort of all in on next summer, which means I was just looking at guys that I think could be gone this summer. I think Derek Favors is probably the most obvious candidate, although I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he's gone, as it seemed like back in December. I think there's a chance that Alec Burks maybe played himself into some trade value. I think Ricky Rubio might be on the block. For the most part, I think it's all like it's all mites and mays with who might leave the team. Ultimately, I think they're mostly the same team when they come back next season.
I tend to agree with you, and there are stuff that they can do if they really wanted to. There are stuff that they can do to create cap space this year. I have them being able to get up to close to $20 million in room, but you have to waive all your non-guarantees. So Tabo, Jarebko, Udo, Stockton, you can keep O'Neal. I baked that in. You can't get rid of him. That'd be stupid. But then you also have to renounce all your own free agents, Neto, Exum, and Favors. And this is not the market. In a vacuum, it is, because more than two-thirds of the league is going to end up not having cap space. And my favorite example of this is really the Orlando Magic are going into the summer as a capped out team if they carry Aaron Gordon's
That's
hold.
Crazy.
And they're going yeah. to carry Aaron Gordon's hold. And they'll be even more than that if they decide that they want to carry Hezonja's hold because they're not sure if he's going to get I think they can pay him. They can only pay him up to his fourth year team option amount since they declined it. So it was close to $5.2 million. That's like what the landscape is. But the free agents just aren't out there.
Nope.
Bleacher Report and our colleague at NBA Math, founder in chief, Adam Frommel, published a top 10 point guard ranking for free agency. And it's the most depressing shit I have ever read. And he's spot on. There's Chris Paul. And then guess who the second best guy is? And he's not wrong. It's just this is the market.
I'm not even looking at I have no idea.
Isaiah Thomas is still the second best guy.
Oh wow, that's crazy.
Fred VanVleet comes in at number three, but he's really good. But it's just after that you're talking about Elfrid Payton, Rondo. You have Milos Teodosic, and he's not even – I don't even think he'll decline his player option personally. Shabazz Napier is in the top 10. Derrick Rose is in the top 10. That tells you all you need to know right there. And yeah, the Jazz don't need a point guard. I'm just saying this is – when you look at star free agents, this is not – waiting for 2019 would make far more sense for them. But if they wanted to, if there was – you know, if they knew that they could get – you know, say the Bucks weren't willing. This has been your guy. Say the Bucks weren't willing to pay Jabari more than $15 million a year. The Jazz could do some things to come in and beat that offer.
And I go back and forth on that. Even like, is it worth it for Utah to sacrifice the depth that I think has been one of their biggest strengths over the last two seasons to sign
Jabari?
At this point, he's kind of a question mark. Like, I'm still very intrigued by his upside. I don't think he's had great coaching for the first 4 years of his career. He's obviously had terrible luck with injuries. But there's a chance that he's just sort of a high volume, low efficiency, no defense forward. And in today's NBA, you need somebody who can guard all over the floor at your power forward spot. And I'm not sure Jabari can do that or ever will be able to. It's an interesting summer for the Jazz. I think do you think Alec Burks has any trade value? I was looking at him last night, and he was out of the rotation by the end of the regular season. He had a great stretch early in the year. In the postseason, he was actually second on the team behind Rudy Gobert in box plus minus and win shares per 48, and he was first on the team in PER. He was awesome in the playoffs, and obviously that's when the most eyes are on the team. I don't know if he has trade value beyond, like, now we don't have to attach a sweetener to him. But I think for the first time in a couple months, it seems like they could move him if they really, really wanted to.
I think they could. I don't know. When you look at the teams with cap space, I don't know why any of them would want to absorb him.
The only team, and you pointed this out like a couple episodes ago, and now I'm just like sending all my Jazz players there. If the Hawks really are serious about taking on money, and then in that situation they would have to attach a sweetener, because I think that's what Atlanta said they were in the market for. But I think, I don't know, something that sends him and maybe Rubio to Atlanta, that's like the only avenue for cap space that I can see. Because I don't know, like you said, I don't know who else wants guys like that have cap space.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you could talk the Bulls into doing something like that if you're going to sweeten it enough, although those are guys who add, and this is the problem, is that they're maybe Atlanta brokers buyouts with them, but a guy like Rubio can add wins to your bottom line.
And yeah, not, even he'll help a team.
Yeah, even in the new draft lottery era, you don't want that. That would be their best bet of creating cap space this year, would be to get rid of contracts so that it doesn't cost you everything to have that cap space. I still don't know whether it makes sense for them to do that this year, because as of now, they're slotted for, and this was me accounting for first round pick holds, they're slotted for more than $45 million in spending power next July. And that could change based on if they want to keep Rubio's hold, and more importantly, how much they give Dante Exum and Derek Favors this year. They're still going to have, I would think, even if you pay Favors and Exum, you should still have a reasonable path to $30 million in room. Because if those guys are costing you more than between $15 and $20 million annually, you've overpaid one of them, would be my guess.
Favors market, well, both of those guys' markets are super interesting. I was looking at Derek Favors last night. He played 1,230 minutes this season as the center. So I did Favors on, Gobert, Bradley, and Udo off. And in those 1,230 minutes, Utah had a 107.2 offensive rating and a 107.2 defensive rating. Identical. And if he's going to come back to Utah, already this season, though, he had more minutes like that than he did as the power forward next to Rudy Gobert. So he's already basically the backup center, and I think they might lean even more into that if they re-sign him. I'm not sure if that's something Derek Favors is even interested in. I think he definitely still thinks he's a starting caliber four. Maybe he's learned that he's more of a five in today's NBA than he was 4 or 5 years ago. I still think, despite the fact that they have that bad defense when he's the center, I still think he's probably one of the better backup fives in the NBA, if that's what he is for Utah going forward. But I wouldn't blame him if he wants to move on somewhere else to have a bigger role. It's just we run into the same problem we're going to run into with every free agent, that there's just not a lot of teams out there who can give him what he wants monetarily and role-wise.
That's why I think that sign-in trades could be due to make a comeback. Because when
that's, you know what? Maybe that's the nugget I remembered from the Woj pod. Maybe it was Zach Lowe. I don't even know now. I listen to too many podcasts. But somebody was talking about how they think the sign-in trade is going to make a big comeback this summer. And people have even floated the idea of like double sign-in trades this summer. So it could be really, really interesting.
I think Zach Lowe suggested they could do like a Favors and Parker dual sign-in trade. Would be something to monitor.
Which I would be – I'd be all for that. I think that's a much more interesting way to get him onto the roster than having to renounce like half of your bench to make room for one guy. If they could pull something like that off, and I don't know the CBA well enough to know the mechanics of all that and the drawbacks of doing something like that, but that sounds way more interesting to me.
The drawback for them, aside from the fact that they're paying Jabari Parker, and you know how I feel about that, is they're just hard capped, which I don't think is a big problem for them after, because they're not in danger of like they can be one of the few teams that you're hard capped and it's like, oh, okay, that's fine. Even there, if you bake in Dante Exum's and Favors' full cap holds, the Jazz are still under the projected luxury tax apron, so $6 million over the tax. And Derek Favors isn't getting $18 million, and Dante Exum isn't getting $15 million. They'd be fine to do something like that. And Favors could be a good fit in Milwaukee, which is why that's a little interesting. And the Jazz as a partner, because they're flexible, you don't have to worry about sending out, depending on what their cap situation ends up being. The Bucks don't have to worry about taking back dollar for dollar what they end up signing Jabari Parker to. That might be why it appeals to them. If you're the Jazz, though, and I think this is where things get a little difficult for me, is that if the goal is to kind of just build upon this season's finish, maybe you hope for internal growth from Exum. You can hope for a big season from Cephalosha. Maybe you're hoping for something else from O'Neal. They were the best team looking at net rating after the All-Star break. But you still do, even if you're going to account for a leap from from Donovan Mitchell, and I think that's fair, I still think this team kind of needs another reliable and willing shot creator. Because I think Joe Ingles could be that guy, but he doesn't have a selfish gene in his body. So I can't imagine him taking a bunch of pull-ups. I don't want Ricky Rubio to be that guy. Maybe it's Alec Burks, but as you said, how much are you going to play him? Jay Crowder sometimes fancies himself a pull-up artist, and he's just, you know, not. The thing I found interesting with this team, and I sent you something I wrote about this, is they were 21st in field goal percentage on drives and 29th in efficiency when using between three and six dribbles. And the other thing for them was they had, when looking at just rotation players, they had two guys who averaged more than 0.5 pull-up field goal attempts per game and shot better than 40% on those looks. Can you guess which two players those were?
More than half a pull-up per game and better than 40%?
Or even 40%, because there are only two guys shooting 40% or better.
Ingles? Is he one?
No.
Oh, my goodness. Rubio?
Yes.
And his late-season surge, I'm sure, carried that stat. And I don't know who the other one would be. I'm thinking Mitchell was below 40%.
He was. He shot 34.6% on pull-up jumpers.
Whew, that's even further below than I thought. Jarebko. I'm just going to throw out a random name.
No, it's actually O'Neal. And he took the bare minimum of pull-ups. And you don't need to take a bunch of pull-up jumpers. It's just, I think you need that other guy you can look to. And Mitchell is that guy. The shooting percentages be damned. Just looking at the havoc he creates when he's in the paint, he's that guy. But you need another guy like that. And I don't want to look at Ricky Rubio and say that he's that guy, which is where I think the appeal for this team when looking at them potentially doing something in free agency comes from.
Do you know what Rubio's numbers were during that crazy closing kick to the season that the Jazz had? I'm sure I've probably shared them on here. I know I've shared them on Twitter. Over their last 31 games, so starting with the game that kicked off their 11-game winning streak, 16 points, 6.1 assists, 5.3 rebounds, 1.6 threes, 1.5 steals, 46.2% from the field, 43.8% from three. Utah's net rating when he was on the floor in those 31 games was plus 17.8, and it was plus 5.1 when he was off the floor. If you can get that version of Ricky Rubio for most of a season, and that's a lot to ask because he's never been that guy, but maybe it just took him a while to adapt to the new team and the new system that he was in, or if you can even get close to that, then maybe he's that second guy. But this is, it's not uncommon for Rubio to shoot much better in the second half of a season than the first half. So I don't think you necessarily want him to. I mean, there was times in the first half of this season where he didn't even look like an NBA player. And I don't think you want to go through that again.
He was a roller coaster for us. Remember, we did the sustainable or nah at the beginning of the season and said his shooting was sustainable. And then like 2 months later, you were like, he's going to be playing overseas by 2019. And then
that was another thing I looked up last night because I remember that hot start. It was the first 8 games of the season. And then it was this closing kick that I just referenced. And I took out every game in the middle, which is obviously a huge chunk of the season. And his numbers were about the same as the ones that I just rattled off. If you can get some version of him that's like the beginning or the end of the season, you have a very, very good player who makes a ton of sense in today's NBA. But there's always that chance that he goes through the spells that he went through in the middle of the year, and those are just crippling. It's really tough to recover from the shooting issues that he can have from time to time.
Yeah, and that's why I don't think you want him as your, you know, second most reliable table setter type deal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because he's anything but reliable when it comes to shooting.
But I still think ultimately, because you look at, you know, his second half kick, but you look at the Jazz in general after the All-Star break, tops in net rating in the league, and you could talk yourself into, I think, a couple of the bigger things that maybe would fly under the radar is, yes, we have the Donovan Mitchell development, but having Tabo Cephalosha as your small ball four, that's going to unlock a bunch of crazy lineups if they keep him and he's healthy. He was good defensively.
He was great.
And if
there was a point in the season where he was like the only dependable guy.
And if you have him and Jay Crowder on the floor at the same time, there you could do all with Rudy Gobert in the middle, and then you have Mitchell, and who do you want? It could be Joe Ingles if you're going to go positionless. There are some crazy things that you could do. Maybe that's what they look toward, because I'm in agreement, especially for the type of player that they need. I don't think Parker is the player they need. I think he is one of the places, they're one of the places where he fits really well. But I would rather them go after a higher-end wing, and that player isn't available this summer. You start talking about Chris Middleton or Jimmy Butler or Klay Thompson or Kawhi Leonard. Some of those are long shots, obviously, but those guys are going to be available unless they sign extensions in 2019.
Yeah, I think Middleton makes a ton of sense. And if they do... obviously, I think Jabari's a super long shot. I don't think I've heard really anything from people who are, you know, connected to the front office that say they're interested in him. I think it's more of a fan-generated thing. But if they do get Jabari Parker, I think he'd have to change his game quite a bit to fit on this team. But he is a guy who can create some things from scratch that maybe other people on this roster can't.
Do you think he needs to change his game too much? He now shoots well on spot-up threes.
How much did he, like, ISO and post-up this year? I should have looked this up before we recorded.
Yeah, mister, I didn't work before we started. I'm just kidding.
I think all this stuff, or all that stuff, would have to go, basically, if you're going to fit in Utah's offense. I think he would mostly be like a catch-and-shoot, maybe attack some closeouts kind of guy.
He used isolation on 9.4% of his offensive plays during the regular season over 31 games.
That's not terrible.
Right. He was in the 23rd percentile of efficiency, which...
That is terrible.
Which is terrible. The other thing that in the playoffs, he was okay on defense too and would probably be even better in a system like the Jazz's. But I would think...
That's where I think they'd help him a lot. I think he'd be better defensively.
And he... I never thought of him, at least this season, as a post-up guy, but I don't have those numbers pulled up. Let me see if I can find them really quickly. He seemed more like the guy you were describing with... probably falls in love with like some junky pull-up shots at times, but they might need a guy who can hit those looks. And yeah, he went to post-ups 3% of his offensive plays during the regular season.
That's fine then.
So I think he could fit. I just think there are players who would fit better for what the Jazz ultimately need to join the Rockets Warriors conversation.
What do you think Exum gets?
Somebody
asked me this in a radio spot, and I don't even know what to say anymore. I feel like it could be anywhere from like 5 to you threw out possibly 15 earlier. I don't.
That was his cap hold, so I was not saying.
I feel like maybe some team would like. Are the Nets still in a position to do stuff like that? Just throw crazy money at restricted free agents. That's like the only situation where I could see a team approaching his cap hold, but I could see it go really low too.
The Nets technically could. They're going to start if they waive Whitehead and renounce Joe Harris, they'll have a little bit more than $15 million in room to begin with. They could get crazy on an offer sheet, particularly if I think Damari Carroll is a piece that you can move now as an expiring contract. So they could get room, even more room than they'll have. I just don't think that them going after another backcourt guy when you have Russell, Lynn, Dinwiddie, you want to play Caris LeVert some minutes.
Caris LeVert, yeah.
But you know what? So that might be, though, the Nets, and you said this and made me think of it, why not maybe Damari Carroll's that one-year stopgap type player that you could target on the trade market that kind of functionally does the same thing that you would try to get in free agency? But
does he make this year?
15.4. So if you traded the Nets Alec Burks as fodder and you needed to include some type of a sweetener, would you do it to get a player like that? Or is it just you would rather just stand completely pat and roll the dice to 2019, keep all your picks, don't give up any? I mean, the Jazz don't really have a bunch of good young players that they would be willing to trade. But that might be an interesting route to go. Even if you went straight up, because Alec Burks makes less money than Damari Carroll. Maybe the Nets are just looking to create room themselves and you can send them Alec Burks in exchange for Damari Carroll.
I think that's kind of interesting. Carroll has played for the Jazz earlier in his career, but I don't think we're ever going to see Atlanta Hawks Damari Carroll again. I would probably rather preserve all my picks and assets, like you said, and wait for 2019, but that is interesting. He's somebody who would be able to slot in at the 3 or the 4 and continue to push Utah towards positionless basketball. I think they're getting closer and closer to that each year. So that would, and I think it certainly fits their vision.
And I believe a straight up trade works. So unless the Nets think that they're going to be able to trade Damari Carroll into someone else's cap space or save even more money, which is always a possibility, then an Alec Burks for Damari, even if the Jazz had to include a future second, just you're saving the Nets about $4 million this summer. And that could be something, if they want to be aggressive in free agency, that they should be super interested in.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. I'm also just going to, I'm curious to see what Alec Burks would do somewhere else. Because I'm just not sure it's ever going to fully work with him and Quinn Snyder.
You could see him being a more effective player when he's allowed to freelance on additional possessions.
Yeah, I think that's his DNA. I think they've tried to get him to be more of a system guy for basically ever since Quinn Snyder's been there, but that's just not the way he is. And they actually needed him to be himself and like create stuff out of nothing in the playoffs. And I think that's one of the reasons he had to play and he had to be, thrust back into the rotation. it's interesting because we've been talking this whole time. They need another guy who can create from scratch, and maybe Alec Burks is that guy, but it just comes in spurts with him. Like, it'll look amazing for that stretch earlier in the season or during the playoffs, but then for most of the other time, it's like you're just hijacking possessions for the sake of hijacking possessions. So if you could ever consistently get the good Alec Burks, I think he'd be a super valuable player. I'm not sure this far into his career we can say that that's ever going to happen.
I agree with everything you would have said there. Are the Jazz going to trade Rudy Gobert, though?
No, although...
Doesn't the inevitable Cleveland trade pops up, right? Like, hasn't it been since they've gotten the Nets pick? They'll give them the Nets pick, and you can take back Rudy Gobert. The Nets pick and filler for Rudy Gobert.
Did somebody actually pose that, right?
I think it's been a thing since they've had the Nets pick. Not a source
it's amazing.
Thing, but just among, like, the
like depths, a Cleveland fan thing?
Low yeah. IQ NBA Twitter, yeah.
No, Rudy Gobert is not going anywhere. Somebody asked an interesting question on Twitter the other day. Who would you rather have, which duo would you rather build around going forward? Gobert and Donovan Mitchell or Nikola Jokic and Gary Harris?
That's a really ridiculously tough
That's
question.
Hard, right? Yeah. I don't know if I have an answer for it. I just thought it was an interesting thought exercise.
I might almost be colored by the way Gary Harris finished the season because he was injured. That's a question.
That's hard.
That's
yeah.
That's a question.
It's really hard. Should we move on to,
well, do you think so? What do you think this team, if they're going to stay as we anticipate, stand pat, what do you think their ceiling moves at all in the right direction, or is it probably right around where they would have finished this year?
I actually think they can get better if they just bring back pretty much the same team. They'll have Jay Crowder for the full season, and as we've documented, that the lineup with Crowder at the four was incredible for the second half of the year. So they can play more positionless with him. I think Donovan Mitchell does get better next season. I think he has a lot of the same sort of explosiveness that made him so fun to watch and such an important part of the Jazz. Plus, I think his efficiency is going to improve. That's sort of the next step. I think he'll figure out how to draw some more free throws. I think he'll improve. I'm still in on Dante Exum. I don't know if you saw my impromptu stat thread on him.
I actually did
it's not been four that. Years. It's been 4 years. He's had tons of injuries. And, you know, the first couple seasons, the advanced numbers were just atrocious. But I still am, like, leaning on some of the flashes that I've seen from him that make me think he still has a chance. And I think, again, positionless basketball. He can play all over the floor. He can be on the floor at the same time as Donovan Mitchell. This is my long way of saying that I still think there's a decent amount of internal improvement with this group.
I'm with you. The Donovan Mitchell one I think is obvious, and as I kind of towed the line of before, the thing I'm most interested in is the Jay Crowder at the four model, and then how Todd Cephalosha might fit into that if you use him and Crowder together. When you Gobert, and I'm looking at cleaning the glass right now, Gobert and Crowder played 704 possessions together as the Jazz's front court. 704 possessions, that's not insubstantial. The Jazz were plus 17.5 points per 100 possessions in that time. 99th percentile of net rating, 87th percentile of offensive efficiency, 113.4 offensive rating, 99th percentile of defense, 95.9. And that their most effective lineup in this situation was Gobert, Crowder, Ingles, Mitchell, Rubio, plus 34.8 points per 100 possessions was their net rating over almost 400 possessions played. So that's not insignificant either. I'd be really interested to see what would happen if you replaced Rubio with Thabo Sefolosha. Maybe you lose too much shot creation, but if you trust Joe Ingles and Donovan Mitchell is going to make that leap, I'd just be very interested to see what that five-man unit could do.
To go like full positionless, that lineup is super interesting.
And that might be something Quinn Snyder tries. I wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. Somebody posed in the SLC dunk thread the other day. It said something like, I'm just not sure how comfortable I would be if Jay Crowder was our starting power forward. next season. And I think there's, I get that. I get the concern, but I just, that lineup was so, so good that, and it, you just rattled off the numbers. They're super impressive. I actually would be kind of interested to see what it's like if they just start games with that lineup. Because defensively, it's ridiculous. And then they can move around, and they have a bunch of guys who can create on offense. I like that lineup a lot.
The final question I have on the Jazz is, what do you think? I think Dante Exum, I don't know what he costs. If he costs them more than his qualifying offer, they overpaid.
Yeah, for sure.
So Derek Favors is more...
I was thinking of his cap hold. What's his qualifying offer?
His qualifying offer, I think, is like... He was the number five pick, so it's got to be like $5 million, maybe $6 million. I looked that up really quick. And what the Derek Favors situation is more interesting to me, though, because I don't think there's going to be like this massive mark. Exum's qualifying offer is $4.3 million, by the way. I bet you
they'll go over that.
Maybe the mini MLE value. I'm not saying that's what they used it, but $5.3 million. Like, why are you giving him more than that?
Yeah, like I said, I could see it going as low as like $5 million. I think he's going to push towards like 7 or 8, though.
That eats into their flexibility beyond next season. And that's why Derek Favors is interesting, because I don't know what would you be willing to pay him, knowing that anything you do is going to knife into that spending power for 2019.
What's the mid-level exception? Is it like 9?
8.6, yeah.
I think he's going to get around there. Whether it's from the Jazz or some other team, there's just no market for big men.
If it's more than, I mean, if you end up paying him and Exum $15 million combined because Favors signed for the mid level, you're sitting pretty. You'll have that clear path to $30 million in 2019.
Do you think anybody would give him? I don't even know what he would be looking for now. Like, nobody's going to give him $15 million a year, right?
No, I'm trying to think of the teams that, like, even on a one-year scale, I don't know why. I don't know why
all the teams that have
cap
space have much different plans. Yeah, I just, and it sucks for those individual players who happen to be free agents this summer, especially if you're a big man. But that's just kind of the reality of this summer, I think.
I could see maybe the Lakers or the Suns throwing out expensive one-year flyers and maybe Favors
if they like. If the Lakers whiff on everybody else or something.
Right. And then he kicks the can until 2019. But that's like, you know, that's not really. Maybe the Mavericks, if they were looking for, they don't want to spend a bunch of money on DeMarcus Cousins or try and go after a Clint Capella, and they decide to create cap space. I don't think the money's going to be out there. And mid-level seems, if I'm the Jazz, I'd pay it. If he cost me the mid-level money, I'd pay it.
I would too. I think if he's under $10 million, you probably bring him back, because the numbers on this team, Favors included, in the like second half of the season were just insane. They finally figured out how to play with each other, and at that point they became one of the best teams in the NBA.
Yeah, I'm with you. Which team do you want to move on to next? I think this will be the last team of the podcast, so choose wisely.
You want to do the Celtics?
Let's do the Celtics.
So that my general approach to all these teams last night was I just kind of looked at which players I thought would be most likely to leave. So for the Jazz, I went with Rubio, Favors, and Burks. With the Celtics, I didn't get too far on them. I think Marcus Smart has a chance to leave, obviously, because he's going to be a restricted free agent. And I think Terry Rozier could possibly be on the trade market. All this talk of possibly trading Hayward or Irving, and we've talked about this, I just think that's way premature. They're going to definitely see what the team looks like with those two guys. But Marcus Smart, like we've said with Favors and Exum, free agency is going to be super interesting this year. And he does so many little things. He's like the ultimate cliche glue guy. But among the 396 players with over 1,000 career three-point attempts, can you guess where Marcus Smart ranks in effective field goal percentage?
What was the sample?
1,000-plus career three-point attempts, and there's 396 players in that group.
385.
395.
Oh, my God.
And this is kind of funny. Ricky Rubio is 396 out of 396. True shooting percentage, Marcus Smart is 393rd out of 396. His shooting, and I don't know if I'll ever get over it. I think he made more of a believer out of me than I ever was before in the postseason. But I just can't get past how much of a liability that has the potential to be. And even with the terrible shooting numbers, he still has an above average box plus minus for his career. He's never been worse than replacement level. Like, he does so many other little things that he's still a valuable player. And then there's all the stuff that he does that will never, ever show up in a stat sheet that makes him valuable too. But I think his value is ultimately capped quite a bit by his offensive limitation. So he's another one that I think is super interesting. I don't know what kind of market will be out there for him.
I think, and this was Zach Lowe again, said it, that he could see Smart signing his qualifying offer because the offers won't be out there. And his qualifying offer is worth about $6.1 million, a little bit less, and that he would revisit the market in 2019. One of him or Terry Rozier, they're not going to pay all three. Irving and Rozier are both free agents in 2019. Rozier will be restricted. They're not paying all three of these guys. It just doesn't...
Yeah, that was my thought for sure.
And if he does sign his qualifying offer, Smart, I'm referencing, does it make it more likely that they just keep all three of them and revisit the situation in July 2019? Or do you still think it'll put pressure on them to move Rozier by the trade deadline?
Is Rozier really going to want to go back to being a third string point guard next season? I mean, he averaged 16.5 points, 5.7 assists, and 5.3 rebounds in the playoffs, and he was top 20 in playoff box plus minus. After he got a taste of that, and maybe he's just the most selfless player there is, but I think it's going to be hard for him to go back to the smaller role that he had.
And it's not even that. Even if he's fine with it, as long as he's getting paid, I don't know that you could say that Boston's going to be the team to pay him.
Yeah. It's definitely an interesting, I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches kind of situation for the Celtics that they have these three guys that all warrant playing. But I think I agree. I don't see them going with all three for very long, even if they do bring all three back as soon as next year.
Who would you keep, him or Marcus Smart?
I think I would probably keep Rozier. Just because if you don't have the most important skill there is in basketball, which is shooting, I just think your value is always going to be limited. And Rozier's not like a super great shooter himself, but at least he's shown flashes of an ability to hit some shots. And he was, like I said, he was super productive in the playoffs. I mean, those are starting guard caliber numbers that he put up in the postseason. So he's slightly more interesting to me than Marcus Smart is.
I tilt toward the other direction. If we were looking at this in a bubble, I think you pick Rozier, but the Celtics already have so many guys who can do what Rozier does, and he wasn't...
That makes sense.
Rozier didn't shoot... I would have to look at these numbers again, but he didn't shoot that well on pull-up jumpers in the playoffs. And
he started super hot, and then by the end of this playoffs, I think he was at like 34% on threes, so you're right.
Right, and you have... What Marcus Smart does for you on defense, he can run, and he's not the best pick-and-roll guy, but he's at least someone you could throw on the court and say, here, run some pick-and-roll. But for someone who's 6'4 and can defend some small-ball fours, that, to me, is harder to replace. Particularly when you're going to look at Marcus Morris will be a free agent after next year, and so you lose a defender in him. You don't know how Jason Tatum's going to hold up against bigger wings later in his career. He should be fine, but you're not going to throw Jaylen Brown on small ball fours. Gordon Hayward's defense will be very interesting following this injury. The number that came up for me when I was doing regular season research for Marcus Smart, 123 players defended more than 50 post-ups during the regular season. Marcus Smart forced turnovers 20%. Of the time on these post-ups.
That's pretty crazy.
That was the 10th best mark among that 123 player sample size.
Is it all big men in front of him?
There is mostly. Do you know who's number one?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Kyle Anderson.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
I know, because he's the future GOAT. But that's just one example. And the things you say that you really can't quantify, his energy, the way he goes after 50-50 balls and is just willing to seemingly sacrifice his body on every play. And I almost appreciate, I know it could probably be more detrimental than not, but I almost appreciate his willingness to shoot threes even though they're not going in. Because there's zero hesitation on his part 75 to 80% of the time. And having someone who's at least willing to shoot is a threat unto itself. It'd be a better threat if they were going in, but the fact that he is going to launch those at least means that defenses have to kind of sort of guard him. They can give him the you have cooties treatment and just stand, you know, 7-8 feet away from him at all points, but he's still going to fire, and that helps your spacing a little bit because you're not – if it's Ben Simmons, you're going to slink further off Ben Simmons at this point than you are Marcus Smart.
Yeah, because at least he'll hit like one out of every four. You make some good points. I think after hearing that, I'm kind of on your side. Like in a vacuum – 1-to-1, it's probably Terry Rozier, but just in terms of how he fits with the Celtics, you're probably right. It probably does make more sense to keep Marcus Smart. I think the other factor that comes into this equation, though, is how much he's going to be paid.
Right.
Like, is there what?
He's what not getting more than. Who's giving him more than the mid-level? Again, we're back at that 8.6 million.
That was kind of my question. Yeah. I can't see. Again, if we run through all the teams that have cap space, it's like the Sixers, the Lakers, the Bulls. Who else has significant cap space?
The Nets could do something, but again, I don't know. Unless you're getting rid of Lynn, Dinwiddie, Russell, one of those guys. And you also have Alan Crabb there. I don't know why they would offer him anything.
None of those teams throwing like $15 million a year at Marcus Smart. That just doesn't make sense for any of them.
Dallas isn't doing it. Indy definitely isn't doing it. He would have been interesting in Indy if Corey Joseph opted out. That might have been. But even then, that wouldn't have been a team that said, hey, here's $12, $13 million a year. The Lakers aren't doing it.
Can you imagine Marcus Smart and Lance Stephenson on the floor at the same time?
I don't want to be honest with you. So maybe if you're the Celtics... there's a team that can offer him the mid-level and promise him more playing time or a bigger role, and maybe that forces you to go a little bit above the mid-level, but that's like the absolute worst-case scenario.
Yeah. Well, and even if somebody does offer him that, they can just match it.
But I'm saying, like, that at his price point, is that maybe
they have to... Yeah, that's fine.
It's just, I don't know. Phoenix needs a point guard, but I don't know that... And they need defense, but I don't know that you can look at Marcus Smart and say... He's the answer. If they were trying to win now, maybe. But how much – again, in this market, why would you go much higher than the mid-level exception? And knowing that the Celtics probably match something close to it, you would have to give him $13, $14 million a year. That's a waste of space.
Yeah, there's no way I'd go that high for Marcus Smart. I think if it's around that mid-level exception, like you just said, I'd probably – go ahead and do it. My next question on the Celtics, do you think they are in the finals next year? I know that's like a huge question to ask.
To me, and I'm still going to say this, even though no one will, it depends on where LeBron is playing.
Yeah.
It's still, the Eastern Conference still runs through him. And I'm
so
not...
here's my next question then. If this year's Celtics had a fully healthy Hayward and Irving, do you still think the Cavs would have beaten them?
Oh. That's a tough question. I don't think Irving would have made as big of a difference as people think in the series. It would have changed some of the things that Tatum and Brown were doing. It would have changed some of the defensive plays that Boston made. But having Hayward, I think that would have been the trump card for me. That yes, they would have beaten Cleveland.
I think they have a really good chance to win the East next year if everybody's healthy.
I mean,
that's
not the least bit bold.
Yeah, I'm super intrigued by the Kyrie, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum Gordon Hayward, Al Horford lineup. I think that's going to be a really tough group.
Isn't it interesting how people try and turn that into a problem, though? They're like, oh, who's going to come off the bench between Tatum and Brown? And the answer is neither of them, because you're going to start Irving, Hayward, Brown, Tatum, and Horford. That's objectively...
I've heard a bunch of people say that Jaylen Brown's going to have an issue with taking fewer shots next year, too, because he's like the odd man out in that group.
He does and not I just seem don't like see someone... That. Yeah, I don't see that from him.
And even if... Al Horford's going to sacrifice shots like it's no big deal.
Al Horford's
he would probably be happy taking five shots a game.
He's going to go four or six shots a game, and he's going to be okay with it.
I wouldn't be surprised if he averaged like 10 points a game next year and is still one of their most impactful players, just because he does so many little things on both ends of the floor. I think they're going to be really, really tough. And you have another switchy wing to sort of cover for the defensive liabilities of Kyrie. That lineup to me is just crazy.
Yeah, and if Hayward recaptures his previous form, he's one of the more, especially when you're looking at his 2016-2017 season, he's one of the league's more underrated wing defenders too. Just a perfect fit for what Boston is going to want to do. Their biggest problem is probably going to be, do we ever play a traditional big again other than Al Horford, and he's not a traditional big. Because Aaron Baines is going to be a free agent, and he's valuable to what they do, but you have Tice. Do you want to give Semi more minutes, even though he's more wing than big?
Tice could definitely fill in some backup 5 minutes.
And when you have Hayward playing, I would assume, a lion's share of his minutes at the four, or Tatum, or however you want to delineate them for those guys, with Marcus Morris there, do you have room for Baines in the same vein that you did this season? Is there a path to him getting, maybe he could get 15 minutes a game on this team, and maybe that's what you want him for? But that's their dilemma, is do we have room for someone like that?
I wonder if they'll ever play lineups where Hayward is technically the five.
I have no doubt in my mind that they'll do that.
Yeah, like they'll have 3 or 4 6-8 guys in Kyrie. That'll be super interesting too. I feel like maybe it's not necessarily Baines, but you probably need at least one real center that you can bring off the bench if you have to play.
And it might as well be traditional Baines style at this point, because he's familiar and he
was good this year, especially in the playoffs.
He's not going to cost you more than the taxpayers mid-level again. Who's giving Aaron Baines more than $5.3 million?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, I think you probably need somebody like that. But for the most part, it is going to – they are – they might even be more ahead of the curve than the Warriors when it comes to positionless basketball.
Oh, without
question. The Warriors play it a ton, but they still have like 4 or 5 centers on their roster. So they are very, very much embracing modern basketball.
Do you – if you're the Celtics, are you concerned about the cost of this roster at all? Because if you bake in –
at some point, yeah.
Smart probably isn't going to get what his free agent hold is. That's $13.6 million. I'd be floored if he got that. Still, even if you penciled him in for the qualifying offer, the Celtics, assuming they keep Baines, are probably still going to be a tax team. Maybe they could draft and stash their first-round pick. Is that? I think being a tax team isn't a problem when you look at the talent on this roster. But if you have a path to avoiding it this year, because if Smart does sign his qualifying offer, you can technically get to a point where you avoid the tax without gutting your roster. That has to become super appealing, right? Because you know that Jaylen Brown's going to be extension eligible next summer, Tatum the summer after that, Irving's hitting free agency, Rozier's hitting free agency. You're going to have to pay Marcus Smart at some point. If it's not this summer, then next. You can decide on some of these contracts, oh, do we keep Rozier or Smart? But if you keep both Irving, if you keep Irving and then one of Rozier or Smart, your tax bill in 2019-2020 is going to be cray-cray. And as you look at their books from there, Al Horford, he could be a free agent in 2019 as well. He has a player option. Gordon Hayward is a player option for 2020-2021, which would also be Jaylen Brown's restricted free agent year, which would also be the year that Jason Tatum is extension eligible.
It's going to be problematic at some point. That's the one drawback of
Do you, and I guess my question then would be, knowing that that's what awaits you, do you try and punt on the tax this year and avoid paying it?
Yeah, I guess if you can get under the luxury tax, you probably want to. The thing that was crossing my mind as you were laying all that out was, what seems like the most likely departure? Let's rule Rozier and Smart out. But of the guys, that are going to make, out of the guys that are going to make big money over the next 5 years, which one do you think is the likely sort of, for lack of a better term, cap casualty? Is it Kyrie?
I would say it's him or Hayward.
That's interesting. The two big money guys from this summer.
Just because...
It depends a lot on what Hayward looks like when he comes back.
Right, and I think just because you want to pride yourself still on having that open-ended window, and Hayward's going to be on the older side, and once Brown and Tatum... You know, it's easy to say that it would be Brown or Tatum now because Irving and Hayward are the better players at this moment. Some people, I'm sure, would make an argument to put Tatum or even Brown over Irving, but I'm just saying those are the guys right now. But when you have to pay Brown and Tatum, think about what is Jaylen Brown going to be in 2 years? What is Jason Tatum going to be in 3 years? Yeah. I think they're going to have to worry about paying Tatum max money. That's how good Jason Tatum is going to be.
Oh, for sure.
And I think Brown, I haven't ruled out Brown being just as – I haven't ruled out him being an equal to Tatum. Looking at their career arcs, those guys are going to be younger, and if they're at that point where they're going to command that type of money, I think you want to keep them. And that, to me, would make it more likely that you get rid of Hayward or Irving. And you, to be honest, you probably have an easier path to replacing Hayward than you do Irving. Unless you want to go super positionless, but just looking at what Kyrie Irving can do off the dribble and your alternative point guard options – Terry Rozier is fine, but I don't know that you want him as your starting point guard of a championship contender. Marcus Smart, you already pointed out all his offensive flaws.
Yeah, I think it was funny how many people were kind of saying that Terry Rozier is as good as Kyrie Irving now. I think we need to pump the brakes on that.
He's not.
Yeah, these are interesting questions, and Boston... Unfortunately, they don't have to face them for a couple years. Like I think we've said a couple times, they can roll with all these guys for at least next year and kind of see how it looks. But it's certainly going to be an issue in a year or two.
Yeah, once you get to 2020, that summer, that's when it becomes a big issue because Irving's presumably on his deal by that point. You'll have one, I think, Terry Rozier or Marcus Smart on a longer-term contract. Al Horford will either have signed a new deal, maybe at a cheaper annual rate, or he'll be entering free agency. And Hayward has that player option, and Jaylen Brown is a restricted free agent. Maybe he has signed an extension by that point. Jason Tatum will also be extension eligible. That's the summer you look towards as they're going to have. Like, next summer, the extent of their issues would probably be choosing two of Rozier, Smart, and Irving. And that's not... That's not Sophie's choice here. You can't go wrong by picking Kyrie Irving and then one of the other two.
Yeah. It's I think I used this term earlier, but it's sort of an embarrassment of riches for the Celtics. They're going to have some issues, but they're all issues that I think just about every other team in the NBA would love to have right now.
I'm going to give you two quick fire questions that are way too premature, but do you think the first one over under on are the Celtics going to win the East next year, the regular season? Do they have the number one seed in the East next year?
I'm going to say yes on that one.
Over under on win total then 59. I'm going to set it at over or under.
Ooh, I'm going to say under because the number that I was thinking as you were saying that question was 55. So I'm going to say under.
You think they match this year's win total?
I think they'll be around there.
I think that's fair because you have to give Hayward some kind of a learning curve just to get his game legs under him, and then you have to figure everything out.
I also think that I think Philadelphia will be better next year, and I think Milwaukee will be better next year, too. I think the East will have slightly more competition for them.
If Milwaukee's not better next year, then Giannis Antetokounmpo is gone. They need to just look for
I have some quick hitter questions for you.
I'm going to plead the fifth on those, so let's move on.
Have you looked at draft stuff at all? Do we have any idea, like, what kind of player we think Utah or Boston might want in the 20s?
I have not gotten that far down on the draft stuff. Have you? I've definitively been in, learning about the lottery prospects mode.
I know a little bit about, like, the 20 to 30 range just because I, you know, follow the Jazz so closely. I think Dante DiVincenzo is interesting for either one of those teams. Have you heard anything about Zanon Moussa?
I have not.
He's this guy from, I think he's, I'm gonna botch his country here. I was going to say, he's Bosnian. Bosnia and Herzegovina. I was going to say Croatian, so I was wrong. He's 19 years old, and he's playing in a pretty high-level league, not as high as Luka Doncic, but his offensive numbers are super impressive for a teenager overseas. I think he's interesting. I think, long story short, both teams are probably going to be looking for more, like, 6'7", 6'8", positionless guys. Obviously, DiVincenzo doesn't quite fit that, but I think he's positionless in the sense that he can play one or two. Kevin Huerter is interesting, too, from Maryland. Really good shooter, has good size. That's sort of my general takeaway for draft for both of these teams. They're probably going to be looking for more guys who lend themselves to the positionless style that they're sort of leaning into.
The Celtic could potentially be looking for a draft and stash guy, too, right? When you just look at how many people are going to have.
That's something that's certainly been in there. And they've done that a decent amount lately too. Obviously they did that with Gershon. That's certainly in play.
I agree with you, probably on all those fronts, especially cause that's what the Jazz more so than the Celtics need, that type of player.
Yeah, for sure. All right. I think we've exhausted the Jazz and the Celtics off season stuff.
What would you think about, what would you think, I don't know if he would fall this far, but one of the later first round guys I've actually looked, like, done research on, what would you think of Troy Brown on either the Jazz or the Celtics? I think a lot of people have had him falling to around 25, so maybe it's not outside the realm of possibility.
He's 18 on Jonathan Givney's top 100 right now, so he's... Yeah, he could definitely be in their range, depending on how things shake out. He's interesting. I'm all in on all these guys in this draft that are like 6'7", 6'8", and have the potential to do a lot of things. And he's still only 18 years old. So that's interesting to me, too. There's a bunch of interesting wings that are 18 still. Zaire Smith, Kevin Knox, Troy Brown, who you just mentioned. I think Moussa just turned 19. So, yeah, there's a bunch of guys. But I think you were going to say more about Troy Brown, and I cut you off.
The thing that I liked about him is that his strengths were the things that he struggled with most while he was at Oregon, is that everyone thinks he's going to be this plug-and-play shooter. He didn't shoot 30% from beyond the arc, and he shot only 35% on his two-point jumpers, which seems like a red flag, but I think you look at his stroke and it's there, and he won't have to create off the dribble as much to start out in the NBA, particularly if he wound up in Utah or Boston. And his 4.1 assists per 40 minutes were just, they were big for me. He's like that 6'7" guy who can run pick and rolls and he'll see over people. I would love to see him fall to Utah. Mostly I'm saying Utah because it seems more realistic. I've seen him go super high in drafts, but I've also seen him fall as low as number 25. That is my contribution to this outside the lottery draft conversation right now.
I'm looking at his numbers right now, and that assist percentage and the steal percentage are both very intriguing to me. And like you said, combine that with size for today's NBA. Yeah, he's very interesting. There's a bunch of wings that are. This is an interesting draft because I think the NBA needs more wings based on where things are going, but the top of the draft is just stacked with these big guys. which is another thing that's going to hurt the market for guys like Derek Favors. Like a team that has cap space, would they rather have Derek Favors for, let's say, $14 or $15 million a year, or would you rather have a guy on a rookie scale contract?
Well, and the other thing with that is because so many of them are kind of near the top of the draft, you're removing a lot of teams with cap space from the equation.
Yeah, for sure.
Think about this. Summer. When you look at if the Kings actually do pass on Doncic, which I still think would be, for his sake, probably good, but I would pick Luka number one. But that, again, we've just seen the extent of my draft analysis, so maybe no one should listen to me. You right now, if you look at Bleacher Report's Jonathan Wasserman, has the Suns, Kings, and Hawks all drafting a big with the top three picks. And if you want to include the Mavericks at five with Jaren Jackson Jr., so four of the top five teams, all four of which are going to have more cap space than most of the league. And if they draft big, that's going to that's going to destroy an already thin market.
That's crazy. For guys like Favors and even DeMarcus Cousins, this was like the worst possible year to be a free agent.
That's why the one thing I might disagree with you on being ready for the offseason to get here, I almost want to fast forward to August. And I don't want to do that because I feel like my wedding will be coming up by then in September and I'll be super stressed. But I think the trade market's going to be more robust than the free agency market, unless we see a bunch of sign and trades, but even that would fall under the trade umbrella for me. But I could see things in July being like, look at all this money that these guys didn't get. And then August is going to be, maybe we don't have a Kyrie Irving style trade demand, but we're just going to see a lot of movement that way.
I bet we could get a decent amount of trades at the draft too.
I hope so.
I think this summer has the potential to be pretty wild, despite the fact that there's no cap space, because it means that teams have to get creative.
Look, I'm here for
it. And how they're going to add guys. I'm here for it, too. And I know you guys are here for it. If you want to talk to us about the offseason for these teams or any other teams, you can find us on Twitter. Dan's at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor at NBA_math. As always, leave us reviews or ratings on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you guys listen, Google Play. Tell your friends to subscribe. We would thoroughly appreciate that. We are excited to be with you through this offseason. Like I said, this is one of my favorite times of the year for basketball, so we will continue to keep you updated on everything that's going on in the offseason with our hot takes that relate to it. And there's still the promo code BENO at the NBA Math Shop, nbamath.com/shop. And until next time, we leave you with the shout out to Benno Udry and to turnover in the post forcing machine, Kyle Anderson.